I said in the last lecture that the study of man begins with the study of four functions: intellectual, emotional, moving, and instinctive. From ordinary psychology and from ordinary thinking, we know that the intellectual functions, thoughts, and so on, are controlled or produced by a certain center, which we call mind or intellect or the brain. And this is quite right. Only, to be fully right, we must understand that other functions are also controlled, each by its own mind or center. Thus, from the point of view of the system, there are four minds or centers which control our ordinary actions: intellectual mind, emotional mind, moving mind, and instinctive mind. In further references to them, we shall call them centers. Each center is quite independent of the others, has its own sphere of action, its own powers, and its own ways of development. Centers, that is, their structure, capacity, strong sides, and defects, belong to essence. Their contents, that is, all that a center acquires, belong to personality. The contents of centers will be explained later. As I have already said, personality is as equally necessary for the development of man as his essence, only it must stand in its right place. This is hardly possible because personality is full of wrong ideas about itself. It does not wish to stand in its right place because its right place is secondary and subordinate, and it does not wish to know the truth about itself. For to know the truth will mean abandoning its false dominant position and occupying the inferior position which rightly belongs to it. The wrong relative positions of essence and personality determine the present disharmonious state of man. And the only way to get out of this disharmonious state is by self-knowledge. To know oneself. This was the first principle and the first demand of old psychological schools. We still remember these words, but have lost their meaning. We think that to know ourselves means to know our peculiarities, our desires, our tastes, our capacities, and our intentions, when in reality it means to know ourselves as machines, that is, to know the structure of one's machine, its parts, functions of different parts, the conditions governing their work, and so on. We realize in a general way that we cannot know any machine without studying it. We must remember this in relation to ourselves and must study our own machines as machines. The means of study is self-observation. There is no other way, and no one can do this work for us. We must do it ourselves. But before this, we must learn how to observe. I mean, we must understand the technical side of observation. We must know that it is necessary to observe different functions and distinguish between them, remembering at the same time about different states of consciousness, about our sleep, and about the many eyes in us. Such observations will very soon give results. First of all, a man will notice that he cannot observe everything he finds in himself impartially. Some things may please him, other things will annoy him, irritate him, even horrify him, and it cannot be otherwise. Man cannot study himself as a remote star or as a curious fossil. Quite naturally, he will like in himself what helps his development and dislike what makes his development more difficult or even impossible. This means that very soon after starting to observe himself, he will begin to distinguish useful features and harmful features in himself, that is, useful or harmful from the point of view of his possible self-knowledge, his possible awakening, his possible development. He will see sides of himself which can become conscious, and sides which cannot become conscious and must be eliminated. In observing himself, he must always remember that his self-study is the first step towards his possible evolution. Now we must see what are those harmful features that man finds in himself. Speaking in general, they are all mechanical manifestations. The first, as has already been said, is lying. Lying is unavoidable in mechanical life. No one can escape it, and the more one thinks that one is free from lying, the more one is in it. Life, as it is, could not exist without lying. But from the psychological side, lying has a different meaning. It means speaking about things one does not know, and even cannot know, as though one knows and can know. You must understand that I do not speak from any moral point of view. We have not yet come to questions of what is good and what is bad by itself. I speak only from a practical point of view, of what is useful and what is harmful to self-study and self-development. Starting in this way, man very soon learns to discover signs by which he can know harmful manifestations in himself. He discovers that the more he can control a manifestation, the less harmful it can be, and that the less he can control it, that is, the more mechanical it is, the more harmful it can be. When man understands this, he becomes afraid of lying, again, not on moral grounds, but on the grounds that he cannot control his lying, and that lying controls him, that is, his other functions. The second dangerous feature he finds in himself is imagination. Very soon after starting his observation of himself, he comes to the conclusion that the chief obstacle to observation is imagination. He wishes to observe something, but instead of that, imagination starts in him on the same subject, and he forgets about observation. Very soon he realizes that people ascribe to the word imagination a quite artificial and quite undeserved meaning in the sense of creative or selective faculty. He realizes that imagination is a destructive faculty, that he can never control it, and that it always carries him away from his more conscious decisions in a direction in which he has no intention of going. Imagination is almost as bad as lying. It is, in fact, lying to oneself. Man starts to imagine something in order to please himself, and very soon he begins to believe what he imagines, or at least some of it. Further, or even before that, one finds many very dangerous effects in the expression of negative emotions. The term negative emotions means all emotions of violence or depression, self-pity, anger, suspicion, fear, annoyance, boredom, mistrust, jealousy, and so on. Ordinarily, one accepts this expression of negative emotions as quite natural and even necessary. Very often, people call it sincerity. Of course, it has nothing to do with sincerity. It is simply a sign of weakness in man, a sign of bad temper, and of incapacity to keep his grievances to himself. Man realizes this when he tries to oppose it, and by this he learns another lesson. He realizes that in relation to mechanical manifestations, it is not enough to observe them, it is necessary to resist them, because without resisting them, one cannot observe them. They happen so quickly, so habitually, and so imperceptibly that one cannot notice them if one does not make sufficient efforts to create obstacles for them. After the expression of negative emotions, one notices in oneself or in other people another curious mechanical feature. This is talking. There is no harm in talking by itself, but with some people, especially with those who notice it least, it really becomes a vice. They talk all the time, everywhere they happen to be, while working, while traveling, even while sleeping. They never stop talking to someone if there is someone to talk to, and if there is no one, they talk to themselves. This too must not only be observed, but resisted as much as possible. With unresisted talking one cannot observe anything, and all the results of a man's observations will immediately evaporate in talking. The difficulties he has in observing these four manifestations, lying, imagination, the expression of negative emotions, and unnecessary talking, will show man his utter mechanicalness, and the impossibility even of struggling against this mechanicalness without help, that is, without new knowledge and without actual assistance. For even if a man has received certain material, he forgets to use it, forgets to observe himself. In other words, he falls asleep again, and must always be awakened. This falling asleep has certain definite features of its own, unknown or at least unregistered and unnamed in ordinary psychology. These features need special study. There are two of them. The first is called identification. Identifying, or identification, is a curious state in which man passes more than half of his life. He identifies with everything, with what he says, what he feels, what he believes, what he does not believe, what he wishes, what he does not wish, what attracts him, what repels him. Everything absorbs him, and he cannot separate himself from the idea, the feeling, or the object that absorbed him. This means that in the state of identification, man is incapable of looking impartially on the object of his identification. It is difficult to find the smallest thing with which man is unable to identify. At the same time, in a state of identification, man has even less control over his mechanical reactions than at any other time. Such manifestations as lying, imagination, the expression of negative emotions, and constant talking need identification. They cannot exist without identification. If man could get rid of identification, he could get rid of many useless and foolish manifestations. Identification, its meaning, causes, and results, is extremely well described in the Philokalia, which was mentioned in the first lecture. But no trace of understanding of it can be found in modern psychology. It is a quite forgotten psychological discovery. The second sleep-producing state, akin to identification, is considering. Actually, considering is identification with people. It is a state in which man constantly worries about what other people think of him, whether they give him his due, whether they admire him enough, and so on and so on. Considering plays a very important part in everyone's life, but in some people it becomes an obsession. All their lives are filled with considering, that is, worry, doubt, and suspicion, and there remains no place for anything else. The myth of the inferiority complex and other complexes is created by the vaguely realized but not understood phenomenon of identification and considering. Both identifying and considering must be observed most seriously. Only full knowledge of them can diminish them. If one cannot see them in oneself, one can easily see them in other people. But one must remember that one in no way differs from others. In this sense, all people are equal. Returning now to what was said before, we must try to understand more clearly how the development of man must begin, and in what way self-study can help this beginning. From the very start, we meet with a difficulty in our language. For instance, we want to speak about man from the point of view of evolution, but the word man in ordinary language does not admit of any variation or any gradation. Man who is never conscious and never suspects it, man who is struggling to become conscious, man who is fully conscious, It is all the same for our language. It is always man in every case. In order to avoid this difficulty and to help the student in classifying his new ideas, the system divides man into 7 categories. The first 3 categories are practically on the same level. Man number 1, a man in whom the moving or instinctive centers predominate over the intellectual and emotional, that is, physical man. Man number 2, a man in whom the emotional center predominates over the intellectual, moving, and instinctive, emotional man. Man number 3, a man in whom the intellectual center predominates over the emotional, moving, and instinctive, intellectual man. In ordinary life, we meet only these 3 categories of man. Each one of us and everyone we know is either number 1, number 2, or number 3. There are higher categories of man, but men are not born already belonging to these higher categories. They are all born number 1, number 2, number 3, and can reach higher categories only through schools. Man number 4 is not born as such. He is a product of school culture. He differs from man number 1, number 2, and number 3 by his knowledge of himself, by his understanding of his position, and, as it is expressed technically, by his having acquired a permanent center of gravity. This last means that the idea of acquiring unity, consciousness, permanent I, and will, that is, the idea of his development, has already become for him more important than his other interests. It must be added to the characteristics of man number 4 that his functions and centers are more balanced in a way in which they could not be balanced without work on himself, according to school principles and methods. Man number 5 is a man who has acquired unity and self-consciousness. He is different from ordinary man because in him one of the higher centers already works, and he has many functions and powers that an ordinary man, that is, man number 1, 2, and 3, does not possess. Man number 6 is a man who has acquired objective consciousness. Another higher center works in him. He possesses many more new faculties and powers beyond the understanding of an ordinary man. Man number 7 is a man who has attained all that a man can attain. He has a permanent I and free will. He can control all the states of consciousness in himself, and he already cannot lose anything he has acquired. According to another description, he is immortal within the limits of the solar system. Understanding of this division of man into 7 categories is very important, for the division has very many applications in all possible ways of studying human activity. It gives, in the hands of those who understand it, a very strong and a very fine instrument or tool for the definition of manifestations which, without it, are impossible to define. Take, for instance, the general concepts of religion, art, science, and philosophy. Beginning with religion, we can see at once that there must be a religion of man number 1, that is, all forms of fetishism, no matter how they are called. A religion of man number 2, that is, emotional, sentimental religion, passing sometimes into fanaticism, the crudest forms of intolerance, persecution of heretics, and so on, and a religion of man number 3, that is, theoretical, scholastic religion, full of argument about words, forms, rituals, which become more important than anything else. A religion of man number 4, that is, the religion of man who works for self-development. Religion of man number 5, that is the religion of a man who has attained unity and can see and know many things that man number 1, 2, and 3 can neither see nor know. Then a religion of man number 6 and a religion of man number 7, about neither of which we can know anything. The same division applies to art, science, and philosophy. There must be an art of man number 1, an art of man number 2, an art of man number 3, science of man number 1, science of man number 2, science of man number 3, science of man number 4, and so on. You must try to find examples of these for yourselves. This expansion of concepts greatly enlarges our possibility of finding right solutions to many of our problems. And this means that the system gives us the possibility of studying a new language, that is, new for us, which will connect for us ideas of different categories which are, in reality, united, and divide ideas of seemingly the same categories which are, in reality, different. The division of the word man into 7 words, man number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, with all that follows, is an example of this new language. This gives us the 4th definition of psychology as the study of a new language. And this new language is a universal language, which people sometimes try to find or invent. The expression a universal language or philosophical language must not be taken in a metaphorical sense. The language is universal in the same sense as mathematical symbols are universal. And besides that, it includes in itself all that people can think about. And besides that, it includes in itself all that people can think about. Even the few words of this language which have been explained give you the possibility of thinking and speaking with more precision than is possible in ordinary language, using any of the existing scientific or philosophical terminologies and nomenclatures.